Welcome to Too Many RPGs, a show about RPG shows.
From the abyss steps forward someone whom we kind of know to tell us about a show. They bring us information. And I can't keep this rhyme up because I'm bad at rhymes. Basically, this is a show where we get a guest on who talks about either a show that they really enjoy or are a part of, and they talk to us about it. And then, yeah, that's how that works.
Oh, my favorite part about that is where you just try and salvage it. Oh, man.
It's perfect. Don't worry about it.
Okay, it's perfect. It's great. This week, I'm really excited because we have Grant. Grant Ellis, the magician of tabletop RPGs, to tell us about his crazy awesome Invisible Sun project.
I want you to tell me right now the strangest, most surreal thing at the top of your head.
This conversation.
Okay. Because I was thinking about snails that live inside sneakers.
That is more surreal than this conversation, but only slight. But we're talking about it now, so now this conversation is more surreal, potentially. I don't know. Or equally surreal.
Oh! You have like a... Whatever we say, the conversation is all of.
Yes.
And contains all surrealism. I think you do win.
I mean, I don't... I was trying...
You infinity plus one me.
Yeah, I wasn't aware it was a competition. Here's Grant. Let's talk to Grant.
And this week we're talking to Grant Ellis about Invisible Sun.
Ooh, hello, Grant.
Dun, dun, dun. Hello.
So tell me about, gosh, there's so much to unpack. Talk to me about the project first. Like, talk to me about your whole crazy mega project.
Okay. That would be the life of Grant Ellis. Within that life, there is a subset project, which is my heart and soul and love for tabletop role-playing games, where I am running a campaign called Across the Actuality, which is four interwoven Invisible Sun narratives. Invisible Sun being a tabletop role-playing game by Monte Cook Games that was released a couple months ago. This being late September, it was shipped in mid-July. And really what I'm doing is I'm playing with people from all across the entire spectrum of humanity. And we are telling magical stories in a surreal world and having a lot of fun doing it.
Very cool. Now let's talk about Invisible Sun, the game, because this is like, I have lots of questions about this game. First of all, it comes in a very large, like, Vanta black box.
Yeah, roughly 33-pound black cube with everything that you need to play inside.
Okay, so...
I'm wondering where you're going with this.
I want to know about, like, I mean, maybe nobody's heard about this before.
Okay, I'll talk about it. So you open the cube and it begins with a sheet of paper that explains that you have summoned the black cube. Now behold all of its treasures. And then it gives you a procedural method of going through the black cube. Since there's so much content inside, the designers wanted to make sure that you wouldn't get lost. So they give you roughly a 9-step process of going through each component in the cube, and they then instruct how they advise you to read the books. Essentially going in order, they recommend you read this book first, and then they recommend a second book. They explain the different approaches you should take based on whether or not you are a player or a game master when going through the books. I'm going to leave a picture in Discord so you can see all the components if you do open one of these things, because I think it's pretty cool. It is a role-playing game that makes extensive use of the fact that it is in fact a game, and there's a lot of traditional game components, such as there is a game board, there are playing cards, there are tokens, there are dice, and all of these things are important to the game. Whether you're playing online or in person, you need the game board every session. Whether you are playing online or in person, you will need dice, most likely. You can use a counter tracker instead of the tokens, but the game's much easier and faster to play with the little tokens, which represent good things and bad things that happen to your character. There are four beautiful books, an art book full of inspirational artwork. There is an envelope that is sealed with a wax seal labeled Secrets. And if you read that envelope, congratulations, you now have to be a game master. You cannot be a player if you've read those secrets. There are secret compartments hidden in the black box where additional spells, secrets, information about the lore are hidden. Likewise, there's secrets in other game components as well that if you decipher the code that comes as a part of all the products, meaning if you look at the covers of those books, you can translate them once you learn the code and decipher the cipher, so to speak. So it's a very elaborate game. It's a very deluxe game. A lot of love, care, and craftsmanship went into the product. As far as cost, a cube typically goes for about $220. And some people say that's very expensive. However, if you add up the cost of the three Dungeons & Dragons core books, one adventure, the Dungeon Master screen, packet of D&D character sheets, it quickly surpasses the amount of Invisible Sun in cost relatively quickly. So they did their best to make the game affordable as well as include everything that you need inside that box.
So it's like a large down payment, but then you have everything you need to play the game forever.
Mm-hmm. And they have options for groups to go in part way, meaning each player can pay $40 or, you know, you can down pay portions of it depending on essentially your financial situation. And then if you're like me, I went into the game and my mission is to run it for everyone, as many people, and to also create a subset of digital tools and components that will help facilitate running the game.
Wow. So this is very, I don't know, I'm overwhelmed by looking at all of these, like looking at all this picture. Have you used all of this stuff while playing the game or?
So to play the game itself, you can break it down into very basic components. You have characters, so the characters need sheets to keep track of their character. I have gone through all the books because one of the books gives you essentially here's how you make a character and what it means to be a character in the game. The second book explains here is the game's philosophy towards magic. The third book is here's everything lore-wise about the game. And the fourth book is, here's how you run it mechanically as a game master. I have used the Soothe deck and the Path of Suns, which is the game board. In every game you have to. It's an integral part of the game where the way magic works and functions changes based on story events. And those are codified story events. And yeah, I think it's fair to say that I've used every component in some regard. However, you're usually dealing with bits, pieces, and portions at a time. And, you know, you're not using a massive stack of spell cards. It's just each player might have two.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've run the game as it was designed is probably the safest way to say it.
I have a question about secret envelopes.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a human being, right? You're given an envelope of secrets.
Yes.
That once you open, you can't be a player anymore?
Well,
you have to GM.
Currently, my feeling is you would need to be a game master under the current narrative. Now, Monty Cook already has supplements planned and prepared, and there's a chance that the narrative changes over time as the actuality is altered. And it could be that there's other components and aspects of the actuality that will cause you to be able to play. With that said, if you know these secrets in that envelope, you cannot play the narrative using those secrets, meaning you've discovered them, right? It's the same. Okay. Yeah, you know that. It'd be the same as if I sold you a D&D module, the North Seat, available on Roll20 and DriveThruRPG. Right? So if I ran the North Seat for you, you've run it and read it, and you would know information about it. So I'd have to modify the adventure in order to empower you to discover. Yeah, so I would have to redesign the secrets. And with that said, I'm quickly realizing the more I run this game, the more you could most definitely be a player in Invisible Sun, because so much of it is player-driven that I'm discovering new things about the game all the time based on information and creation that my players participate in.
So I've watched, I think, two of the four, like, first episodes where you're doing world building.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've found very interesting is that of those two groups, because of who you have on the show, their world creation methods, even though they're the same, like, let's talk about this now, but their methods of doing that is so different. Like, you have one team that's talking about, like, a badger who digs underground and gives people trash.
Mr. Badger.
And another, in another game, that's like, oh yeah, I have a house that runs around and bites people.
Yeah, yeah, and that's interesting to note, too. And those two of my favorite players, both Elle and Jordan Shively, the author and game designer. So, yeah, and interesting to note, both those things exist in the same actuality, and it's fair.
Right.
But the creativity is what makes it so magical to me. You know, that's just the fact that you can have Mr. Badger walking around. He's larger than life, leaving trash everywhere and interrupting dinners. And you can also have one of the characters literally lives in a house that has grown legs, walks around the neighborhood, and bites other houses.
And contaminated with, like, rabies or something.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the other thing, too.
So does it start like a weird house zombie plague?
That's what we think's happening.
That's what we think.
Oh, my God.
So let's talk a little bit about, in the game and in the RPG community. The RPG community has this idea of session zeros and session zeros are important. What Monty Cook does is take the idea of a session zero and call it the first session. It's not this, you're not playing the game. You are going to meet as players, and you cannot play the game unless you've had the first session. You cannot play the game. So you meet together and you talk about your different role-playing styles. They simplify it into four types: builders, achievers, etc. You know, they explorers, attainers. I like to add to the world. I like to focus on character optimization. I like to focus on story goals. I like to discover new things. And you're not bound to that, but you just talk about them, and they give you a very simple way to talk about them. Then you introduce your characters, and then you start together finishing the act of character creation together as a group. And there are mechanical rewards that come through that session. And then at the end of that session, you take the information that you created, and some of the things you go through are your character's house, what it's like, if they have a house, if they don't have a house, where do they stay? Who are their neighbors? You don't necessarily get to pick your neighbors, who lives on either side of them. What are some points of interest in the neighborhood? What are two or three places near where this character lives, and what are the stories tied to those things? What are some local problems, rumors, and issues? And you go through all of this, and you take turns awarding people who gave really good ideas. During the character creation session, you go through the entire group. Then you establish character bonds, and you tie your characters together and determine, based on what is written in the rule book, we are best friends. My character will experience this if we are in this situation. That's a very ambiguous and generic way of saying, I will receive an experience point if you end up in a tough spot, because I will feel despair. The game uses three mechanical equivalents of experience point: acumen, by doing things, you know, completing story moments, then joy and despair, the things that make your character happy and the things that make them sad. You combine joy and despair to form a crux, and that allows you to advance your character. And what those things are, joy and despair, is unique to every player and every character in the game, based on decisions you make at the time of character creation. So you go through this as a group, and then lastly, you reach the desideratum, which is, we as a group are deciding we would like the story to begin with a focus on, and then it lists out six things. It might be obtain more information, it might be travel to a new location, it might be obtain allies or other forms of power, but you decide that as a group, and then you give all this information to the game master. Now they're ready to start crafting your group's narrative. And so, you know, the game has secrets, and you discover those secrets, but it's also very unique and individualized to every group. And then in my case, you have four groups that are making it very unique for everyone.
So tell me a little bit about interactions between each of these groups. It all takes place in the same world, actuality, narrative. Mm-hmm. How do you imagine that working? Are people from different shows going to show up on different...
They have. In fact, we had... So I run three shows right now, with the fourth one launching in mid to late October. And my three shows are My Neon Life, Among the Casually Unreal, Unearthly Twilights, and A Star-Crossed Rose in the Garden of Midnight. and we had two players that could not make a session. The game has mechanics and modes to allow players to miss sessions and still advance their narrative. So I advanced the story between the absent players. One of them, we did a video conference and played out the scene of what his character was doing while he was away. The other one, we just had a Google Doc, and I would write out situations, they would respond, and so they're still able to advance their stories while their characters are away. And then we brought in guest stars from the two other shows. So this was the middle show. We had someone from the Monday night show, and we had someone from the Saturday show guest star, and they had bonds. And it made sense that their characters would know the members of the other party. Either they belonged to the same order of magic, or they knew each other in the neighborhood, and they participated. And then we have a Discord that our patrons have access to, as well as our players, where they can play out side scenes, essentially continue the narrative with whoever they want who exists in the game world. And you don't need a game master present to have a side scene unless it's mechanically appropriate. Meaning, you know, I got a message yesterday. One of the players said, okay, we've reached a really dramatic moment and we need you to play a card to determine the narrative outcome of the scene. We think it'll go a couple of different ways, but could you please play the card and we'll live with the consequences. Well, those are two players in two very different games, and they really liked it though. And they had created artwork. One of the players is writing flash fiction, and it also advances the story for the Saturday show, because the player who's playing on Saturday had their story advanced. So they'll come in with a much more clear focus on Saturday.
Well, that's very cool. I have played in games before. We've done kind of text conversations on the side if it's not, you know, if it's something that's only important to two characters and you don't want to take up a whole lot of, like, session time. And then, you know, every so often there's, like, dice rolls. So I like the idea that that is encouraged and supported in this.
And that's what they discover. They're like, man, wouldn't it be great if your players could just play the game? on what we'll call a grown-up schedule.
That's one of those things that Monte Cook Games does two things really well. One, they do physical props very well, like between all like the card decks, and I mean the cube itself, if you go look up, is a beautiful set of things, right? The second, I think, is actually just playing philosophy, not like game design. It's just like, how do people want to play games? They do very well. And I think this is sort of a natural digression into, or not digression, but like a natural movement towards that.
Progression?
Some sort of word. But it's a movement towards this, like...
It's aggression. A space aggression towards something.
Yeah, and it's a different space of play. And one of their philosophies behind game design is, however the game rewards players, that is what the players are going to spend their time doing. So if this is a game about telling magical stories, they have three different experience point systems, where one is, okay, each player in the game has a character, and the character has a character arc. You cannot have a character that does not have a character arc. And then they list out, the same as if you're reading a book on storytelling, these are the story beats associated with a character arc called Fall from Grace, or Discover a Secret, or Discover a Mystery, Uncover a Secret, etc. Romance. These are the story beats. Every step of the story, every beat you obtain, will give you one experience point.
Wait, you get XP for romance?
If you've selected that character arc.
Oh my gosh, I have to play this game now.
It's a good game. It's a good game. And but that's just it. And if you as a player want to see how empowering that is, it's like,
yeah,
you want to play a story with romance. Other players don't have to pursue that. They could pursue, say, a gather information story arc. You both can go to the library in the game, the same library, but for different reasons. It might be your character wants to romance the assistant librarian, the other character is going there to do research, and you can play out all these scenes, and it's so much fun. So the players have narrative control, the game master has narrative authority.
It's very interesting because, yeah, you are basically saying, hey, what do you want to do? I will give you experience for doing the things you want to do, assuming you do them right. Right? Like, it gives a checklist of things to do for how you want to do things.
Ethan, you could get experience for punching things by jumping off really high places and punching them.
Yes.
I could get experience for romancing characters in the same. It'd be amazing.
In the same.
Because, like, in D&D, you get rewarded experience for fighting monsters. That's the game's like, hey, this is how you get XP. But in Invisible Sun, you're saying, you ask that question, how do you want to earn XP?
Yes. And you know, there may be some listeners that say, well, you could just do story advancement XP in D&D, or you've played for so many hours, so you advance your character. And it's interesting, that's true. But every new ability they get, for the most part, is designed to help them fight monsters.
Right.
So going right along with that is, again, it's the dungeon master decides when they level up or how much milestone experience a story moment is worth. Not so in Invisible Sun. It's, well, these are the story beats to a romance arc. This is the story beats to a vanquish a foe story arc. If you achieve these beats, you're going to get experience, and you have the opportunity as a player at the end of each session to participate in what's called a character summary. This is how my character changed from the beginning of the session to the end of the session, and this is how they're different. And you as a game master look at their character arc and talk about it with them, and they might gain a few experience points each session, but it also informs you how to progress their story. Okay, next week, if they were investigating their mysterious background, let's assume a player doesn't know about their past. So the first episode, they've declared, you know, that, you know, they have all this evidence that points that they're not who they think they were, and their background is a mystery. The second episode, they are researching into that. The third episode, they are investigating based on their research and talking with people. In the fourth episode might be a discovery. This is who I am. And then the conclusion, they essentially choose a new character arc. You have a denouement just as you would in a play. You know, this it's a great way to play the game. And then that's one form of experience. The other half, joy and despair, are the things that, you know, make character happy and sad. And there's a lot of different things that might be tied to that. It might be your magical order has trained you to be happy when you invent a new spell. So the other thing I like about the game, it has a very graceful system for inventing magic on the fly. Or it might be having a spell named after you, so on and so forth. And you must experience highs and lows as a character in order to advance. So there's a lot of players that really like to be a sad boy, B-O-I. But they've realized, too, they need to get a break from the sad and have some form of joy, even if it's fleeting, in order to continue and progress the game. And what I like about that is it prevents their characters from being one note. And they get to have these beautiful little character moments where it's like, and you know, for 5 whole minutes that session, he was happy, or she was happy, or they were happy. You know, it's really cool to see, especially, I think it's helping us all become better role players. And if not that, storytellers.
Well, that sounds really incredible. I like the idea that you have to experience joy and sorrow to progress, in the same way that I really like in Mouse Guard, where to level up a skill, you have to pass and fail a certain number of tests. You know, that it's not just you're really good at it or you're really bad at it. You gotta find that balance.
Because we talk about this sort of later on usually in the show, but what do you think, I would like an example of this sort of joy and despair moments, right? Because I feel like it's very important to, do I want to play this game, right? Because it is the reward mechanic, and you're talking about that's what players look for.
It's so different, right? Though it's going to depend on you as a player, and we can always talk about it. So here are some examples. Say I am playing a Vance. So this is the math equation, grammar rulebook. If you're going to cast a spell, this is how you cast a spell. It is a science as much as it is an art or anything. And this is how a Vance, which is a type of magic user, might experience joy. It could be they learn a spell of a level higher than any they've learned yet. It might be that they attend the special conclave of Iov for the first time. They create a new Vancian spell that they've named after themselves. That's very important for a Vance, if they've created a spell that is named after themselves. It might be that they spend a month as an instructor and they're, you know, they are the professor at, you know, Hogwarts teaching new Vances how to cast spells, right? That might be an example of how they experience joy as a Vance. Ways they might experience despair are being chastised by higher ranking Vances, or creating a spell, but it doesn't quite make the effect that they wanted it to. You know, they've solved the hunger crisis, but really they just wanted to make dinner, I don't know. Or having an extended separation from members of the Order. Other ways they might experience joy or despair is as they're going through that character arc, based on the results of the arc. It may be that they discovered something and it was a real downer, so they experienced despair. They got a lot of other experience points to, you know, learn new spells, strengthen their skills, and then it might be that at the end of the arc, they achieve joy or despair, which will then advance them in their magical abilities, because you take a joy and despair, combine it into a crux, and use those to advance either your order of magic or what's called your forte, which is your special way of using magic to solve problems. And there's many flavor ones. Summers is, she is adored by the sea.
I love that. That is 100% on brand.
And Jordan Shively's is eats knowledge.
Like,
eats knowledge.
Eats it, like,
nom nom
nom. Nom, nom. Here's a tasty book.
Literally, they were, yes, and he has eaten books. Literally, they were going to cut open another character's head and have Jordan eat his brain to try to figure out where his missing memories were. Decided not to do that, but yeah, there's...
It's good. Don't eat brains.
In fact, that's why the character was like, I need a sight scene. But there's many of them, you know. They caught fire's eye, or they dwell in darkness, or they revel in beauty, or they wander in delirium. They warp time and space. They fuse nightmare to a fist. But they have all these really cool, you know, the verb part of their character sentence, if you're familiar with Cypher system.
Yeah.
So your characters are adjective nouns and verbs.
Yeah, that comes from Cypher, or they do that in Cypher as well, right? Right? You're like, I'm a charming warrior that blazes radiance or whatever.
Yeah, and each of these fortes also provide ways to obtain joy and despair, and also have suggested character arcs based on the nature of the forte. For example, if you have Calls Upon the Serpent, they might suggest that you take the Learn character arc and learn more about the serpent, which is a demon that has possessed the entire city that the majority of the game takes place in.
The reason why I was asking about that is because this game feels like it's teaching you how to write. Like, as a writer, these were sort of lessons that I learned while writing and kind of learning about it, about how to create arcs and how to, you know, make your character experience multiple emotions and get them through interesting stories and to have a purpose.
Yeah, and really, it's not just writing. It's teaching you how to tell stories.
Right.
Because I took the same classes when I started as a filmmaker, and a lot of it resonates and is the same. So what Monty Cook and company are doing, Monty Cook Games, is they are teaching you to use games to tell stories while creating what I'll call story-oriented mechanics to keep it a game. We're not just winging it. The game helps decide the outcome, and you can have a lot of fun while doing it.
Which is really cool. Yeah. It's not just, here are some mechanics, here's how you resolve things, but it's actually, here's how you make an interesting story.
Yes, 100%.
I'm just, like, soaking all of this in. Like, this is so fascinating to me. My question is, this all seems very overwhelming to somebody, like, if you've never played the game before, like, not all of your players have this box.
Yeah, and wouldn't it be great if the designers, in the first page, they give advice to the game master, tell them, okay, your first inclination as you've gotten to this section is you're going to probably skip over it because you've run lots of role-playing games. Don't, in all capital letters, is like, I need to explain to you how this game is different than other games you've played. And then they explain to you, they go, just so you know, and this is in the rules, so it's right, you're going to get things wrong your first few sessions. You're going to forget to play soothe cards when you're supposed to. You're going to forget exactly how all the mechanics work. And they said the nice thing about that game when your stories are just starting out is that's the best time to be making all these mistakes. So by the time you get to all these real riveting moments of the story arcs, you'll have it down. So they give you some advice about how to introduce the various components into the game. There's like 8 different forms of magical practices in the game. There's spells, general spells, cantrips, charms, signs, hexes, etc., which all have different rituals, convocations, invocations. There's a lot. But they let you know, they go, hey, for your first few sessions, don't worry about any of this. Don't worry about what a modality is. Don't introduce it at all. Never mention it. Wait till your players start to get comfortable with the system and then introduce it piece by piece. and understand that the character creation process is ongoing for the entire time that you play the campaign. So let your players know they don't have to worry about getting it right out of the box. Like, I mean, one of my players, they had only ever played 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons. They're like, I'm not optimized for combat. I said, but your character can do so much in this game. Yeah, but... And I'm like, you're an amazing character that can do many, many things. I'm not optimized for combat in real life.
I don't know. I feel like you are very optimized for combat, Grant.
There's some stories.
You could tackle anything.
There's a partner Twitch streamer that lost a wrestling match to me with me using no arms, but we won't name names.
I've heard this story. It's great.
Yeah.
I have not heard this story. You'll have to tell me sometime.
Yes.
Yeah, so I guess that's something that's interesting to point out is that it says in the description that all of your players are magic users.
Yep.
So they all have magic. Is there like a more of like a punch wizard versus like a, I don't know, something else kind of wizard?
I love punch wizards.
Well, it all depends on how you want to use magic. But yeah, you could be burly. You have a lot of freedom as to how you develop your character. And I don't think while playing the game, you could adopt any stereotype. You just start thinking about your character and thinking about their story. It's less about the statistics. Being a Bonnie Cook game, there's not that many. It's more about thinking about who you were, who you are now, and then who you're going to become. And if you're looking for a fun mechanical thing, like having a giant fist and going around punching demons in the face, you can totally make that character in this game. In fact, it's probably one of the pre-gens. But also...
Sorry. I just had a great visual image of just some dude, just like a librarian, but they had this giant magic fist and they're just running around punching demons.
And I really want that character in my next session.
I think that's Ethan's next character. Just, I wonder if you could make a character that could punch and throw sharks at the same. You don't have to choose anymore. I think that's the whole point of Invisible Sun, is that finally, you don't have to choose between punching things and throwing sharks.
It's like, what's that on the horizon? Our worst nightmare. Just the sharks and the fists come flying in.
I'm a punchy librarian who throws sharks.
The most fun thing is playing with all the artwork in the game.
It's so good.
Very inspirational. I've commissioned many pieces outside of the game just because... Yeah, it's just very, very, very inspiring. I really enjoy surrealism. It's my jam.
That's something we should talk about, too, is the... You mentioned the directed campaign.
Mm-hmm. So I play in the directed campaign, too, and I'll talk about it a little bit. I'll let you continue, and then I'll blab about it.
I find that very interesting, where... I feel like Monty Hook Games has realized that they have an audience, like, they have human beings that they interact with, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, wait, we can make stuff for people, like, instead of just, like, making Storm King's Thunder, right? And everyone can play this game, but it's a little more like, as I understand it, they've written it for you to use?
So, here's how the directed campaign works. You take the game Invisible Sun, and then you become a member of the Sodality of Secrets, which is an organization that you belong to by paying to be a member of the directed campaign. You get access to a private forum where the most prominent members are the Monty Cook Games design team. They consult with you on your campaign. Over the course of your campaign, they will build, create, and mail props to your players if your players consent to give their address. They will provide you each month with a packet that will have props, maps, artworks, play suggestions. And after the first 3 months, they're asking you as an individual specific questions about your group. For example, they know my players and, you know, they might probe a little deeper and say, well, this character eats knowledge. Has he eaten any interesting books recently? And then they'll consult with me on that narrative. And then they will make a prop and mail it to them. It might be they receive an invitation in the mail to attend a secret Vizslay magic user party. It might be that they get a signet ring of an order of wizards. Many different possibilities.
So it's less of a module and more like a story beat, which is most of the game anyway. That's how the game runs.
Well, here's what I will also say. The first month, I received 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, about 20 documents parted out an animated video loop, business cards of NPCs they'd meet, signs of buildings, menus at restaurants that the players would be attending, advice for running the first session, advice for on how to build upon that first session, as well as, oh, hey, by the way, here's a bonus encounter that could fill up a night or two of gaming. Yeah, and it makes me feel, you know, really good, as well as a print-friendly version of all the props.
This sounds amazing.
It is.
Yeah, it really does.
I love these little, like, you're talking about restaurant menus. That is my jam. Personally, like, me as Ethan, I enjoy knowing what's on the menu at the restaurant that I'm sitting down at in an RPG.
And it makes it very easy for your characters to order
right.
as well. Like, you don't have to wing it. They can just read from the menu. Like, it's so nice.
I kind of like the idea of also, like, getting stuff mailed to you. Like,
yeah.
That's like, you know, those mystery boxes that company does that, like, mails mm-hmm. you stuff and you go on an adventure. And it's like, you get an adventure in the mail one day. You're just like, la la la, and here's the new book that I ate. What?
Yep.
Now I know the thing my character knows because I read this book that my character ate. Like, that's crazy.
It's also very interesting because it lets the company give out information in a way that isn't completely overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. A little bit here at a time.
You could release a tome on the actuality, but is that useful? It seems almost better that they're like, okay, where are you? Where are you at in the story?
Yep.
Oh, hey, you're at this point in the story. Let's give you this information.
Yeah, and it's so highly personalized to you, so you know exactly what you need at this time. Because sometimes that happens, like, when you're reading the D&D books and you're like, I'm here. Your players are here and they have a question about something that was like 5 chapters ago and you have to be like, okay, how do I do that? And I mean, that's not bad. That's just, you have to make decisions about where things go and how to put things when you're trying to put all of your information in all at once. But this way you can just...
Also, Grant has throughout the entirety of this conversation been throwing stuff into our chat.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much!
There's
yeah.
This is so good!
Much. This is very
so
good.
So much good stuff! I love this, like, town map.
Yeah,
yeah.
And the nice thing about that
whoa.
Story is...
Whoa, that animation.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Thomas the Ghost. But the, so my players on the Wednesday night show, that street, for all intents and purposes, as far as they can tell, has been ripped from all existence. The street's not there anymore, and all memories of the street are gone, except my players remember that street. And they have, you know, business cards of friends of theirs who lived on that street. They're like, no, wait, we know the Limerent Street's there. I have proof and evidence. Mercy, I'm supposed to go see Mercy because she's going to help me obtain the Locked Secrets Beast. She is the Goetic that can summon that monster, and that monster is going to tell me where I can find my family, because it is the monster of Locked Secrets. Mercy gave me her card, should I ever need her. Limerent Street is completely gone. And it is. Like, so that's what they've been searching for. And yeah, there's...
Oh my gosh.
I love the idea that you're looking for a street, not in any, like, a pedestrian sort of way, just like, we're looking for the idea of this street.
And yeah. Everyone thinks they're crazy, but...
I imagine it to be like one of those Mad Magazine things where you have to, like, fold the pages together in
oh,
a specific
no.
way to get, like, a different picture.
Now I'm wondering if I have to do that with this image and it's gonna reveal secrets.
Oh gosh, no!
That's another thing I want to talk about. All of the, like, crazy secret things that... I mean, it looks like you might have to with the way that the that bridge across those two buildings is folded, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, is that you told me this game launched with a big ARG event. There's lots of, like, you find this thing and it takes you to a website that...
Are we allowed to talk about this?
Are we?
Sure. So you can probably talk about anything that's on the Wikia.
Okay.
I'm going to post in your Discord the game launched ARG event. Well, these are things that have been around for years. So there was a big alternate reality game that launched before Invisible Sun was announced. It started with a website called pathofsuns.com. And over time, you could listen to audio files talking about angels on street corners and Shadow and an organization called Hindassa. And if you crack the code on that site, it would give you geocaches. And over time, if you got to the the geocaches, you found messages saying it's coming, and then a Kickstarter launched, and over time there was it pointed to a game store that had a puzzle sitting on the table, and if you showed up and solved the puzzle, it would give you another secret that pointed somewhere else, and this is all through the game still. Like, there are many, many codes throughout the books. There are many riddles that remain unsolved. There are email addresses that you can decipher email, and it will give you a story snippet and a magic spell specific to you for solving that riddle.
Which is mind-boggling. Yeah. Like, as someone who's done some design work for games, like, the fact that there's so much and they didn't want to just give it to you, right? Like, they have all this information and they're constantly creating it. Like, this game is so good.
It's very good.
Conceptually, it is so good.
It's very cool.
Just the idea of it. Yeah. I'm just gonna go have my bean explode for a second.
Yeah. Can we talk? I want to ask you about the hand.
Yes.
Is it a spoiler to talk about the hand?
We can talk about some aspects of it. So the hand is the Testament of Suns. And the Testament of Suns goes across the Vislay words Vertulicata. That's actually part of it. So
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata. And every Vislay, every magic user that belongs to a magical order carries one, unless you are an apostate, which means you have something else. You don't believe in orders. So the Testament of Suns is a six-fingered hand that represents your order, your heart, your foundation, your forte, and essentially who you are. And there are secrets tied to this.
Yeah, and for the listeners at home, you get a gold hand statue in the box, in the cube, and I've been obsessed with it ever since Grant showed me a picture.
Oh, it's great.
And it's full of secrets, and it's... I only just realized it's six fingers. I've been looking at it for months, and I did not realize it had six fingers, so, like, it's crazy.
Some good old-fashioned Monty Cook witchcraft. Now, and you know what? I'm just gonna say, so there's eight paths along the Path of Suns, then there's the ninth sun, the invisible sun, which represents magic, which light shines upon all things. I was sent a box of cards, an extra box of cards from Monty Cook Game, because I was a pre-order for the game, and I was sorting the cards, and a little sheet of paper fell out, and it had a secret on it that blew my mind about everything I knew about the suns. I'm not going to repeat it here, but if you have a box of the Soothe deck, pull out the little sheet of paper, and it's like, what? What? What?
I like this because it feels like you as a GM, like, have a whole, like, because usually when you're GMing a game, you get all of the, like, you're the imparter of the surprise, you're the imparter of the mind blowing. What Monty Cook Games has done is, like, giving you something to do.
Yeah, and also, through play, little things like this allow you, as a game master, to discover as much about the world, you know, right? So I have little things to do, like solving all these secrets, as well as when we're playing the game and this stuff comes out, I'm as surprised as everyone else.
That's amazing to me, because I do love discovery as a concept, and sometimes when you're playing as a GM, what you get to discover is what the players do, right?
Mm-hmm.
But being on that same sort of level where you get to discover things not only that the players are doing, but in the material itself, like, I feel like you are becoming a player. Like, your player character in this setting is the person who has all these things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you have to go and figure out all the puzzles and the ciphers and the...
Yeah. And it has this whole idea of the unreliable narrator thing, too, because you don't know everything, or everything is not as it seems. So if you learn a secret, and then all of a sudden this entire thing that you've been narrating isn't exactly right, and how does that change play?
Can we add unreliable narrator to my business card? As it fits?
Sure. Grant Ellis.
Unreliable narrator.
Unreliable narrator. Esquire. Also some other stuff.
Also too many things.
Also too many other things, yeah.
Every time I hear you talk about things you've done, Grant, I believe everything you say.
Absolutely.
But the list is always growing.
Yes, no, the only things that aren't true are the prison stories. I never went to prison, but I have a bunch of prison stories I tell, mostly at game conventions when people meet me in person for the first time, and they're like, what? No! And then it's like, I'm just messing with you guys.
Grant is the RPG version of the most interesting man in the world. If you told me you spoke French and Russian, I would believe you.
I used to speak French. I don't speak that much Russian, though. I'm fluent in Portuguese.
The last thing I want to talk to you about is a very cool thing you're doing with these games and your Patreon. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how your Patreon functions.
Okay, so my Patreon is the result of a glance around the industry. I was recently offered an opportunity that I decided to pass up for what I called a philosophical difference. And it led me to start a Patreon, patreon.com/GrantREllis. And it serves three goals. The first is equal compensation for player participants, meaning for every dollar that comes to the Patreon, it is divided equally amongst all players. There is essentially a set rate, and it is the equivalent of my player pool divided by all shares. The second is to offset the cost of production, and we do that by giving production an equal share as well. The third is to pay for the creation of digital art and assets that can be put into Creative Commons and public domain, meaning we pay an artist what they want for their artwork, and then we donate that artwork to the community for any role player to use however they want. The artist has received what they asked for, and we pay for that through the Patreon. The last thing I should add is we've started a gamer relief fund where when you receive your share as a player, you're empowered to do with that what you want. Some people say, I want to give this back to production. Others say, there's other players that need this money more than I do. Can you put it in the player relief fund? Which means if a player has a mechanical failure, such as their microphone breaks, or they have a personal tragedy, we as a team can provide relief and assistance to them. Now, in order for a player to get paid what would be the average wage for per hour for a performer in the United States of America, we need to make $3,500 a month. We're not there yet. We're at 1/10 of that amount, though. However, we're transparent in that. And it's like, hey, you know, vote with our dollars, right? Where do we see value? Do we see value in taking care of players and providing assistance for them? Or do we see it elsewhere in the industry? So patrons are empowered to vote with their dollar where they want it to help. And I keep the financials transparent and open so people can see how they're being spent. And most of the rewards for the Patreon are all, I'm putting forth everything. So if you're a $1 patron, you can read a weekly write-up that I do, a Sunday stand-up where I say, these are the things I worked on this week. This is what was challenging about them. Here's what I'm looking to do in the next week. Here's what's going to be challenging about those. And here's the successes I had. A little higher, I give backstage insight into productions or game design work that I'm doing. Higher than that, you get access to the side scenes. So, you know, this game has three modes of play and the game never really stops. Well, we chronicle all these side scenes and release them as a Patreon reward so the audience can fill in the gaps between sessions if they want to. Likewise, we do a monthly chat where anyone can ask any questions about any of the games. And then lastly, the highest tier is people can donate to play in private campaigns, which I run. I run three a month, three sessions. And most of them are with friends, and they're always fun, and it's a great way to introduce new people to game. But that's sort of the reward system and the benefit system of the Patreon. Patreon's there to pay the players for their time because we value their time. Likewise, I don't really believe in a donation system that penalizes or rewards players. You know, I think that sometimes damages the narrative of a game. It can be really fun for charity, and you can have a lot of fun with audience participation by having them pay to donate. I philosophically have moved away from that and say, well, if you want to support the show and the players, here's a Patreon, and here's some rewards that you might like, such as playing in a game or getting additional content. And the audience we've drawn has been more what I'll call fans of the story and less the spectacle. They're following because they're like, look, I have to know what happens to these players. And I know things are going to happen between session. I want to read about one of the characters, Pseudonym Python. Pseudonym Python is going to the Order of the Vance's college campus and is going to be researching for the next month. Well, there's like a 10-page write-up on that whole experience that we've published to the Patreon, and you can read it if you're a patron.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
I love that.
And the reason for that is I got consent from the player to make it a Patreon reward, and they said, by the way, I don't want the other players to know any of this. I want it to be my information. So, but they said we want it documented, and it would be great for the audience to see, to follow the story. So that's what's going on with the Patreon. And we're doing very well in a month. I mean, I launched it with no expectations. So
it's very cool. I really like it, especially, you know, the idea of paying players for your time, because sometimes some of the bigger shows, they will pay people as a performance rate. But for a lot of us, it's just a thing we do for fun. But it's a performance, you know? So
yeah, but here's also where it's born from. There's a lot of people who would be great to play with, but due to financial hardships or society essentially not giving them lots of opportunities, it is a burden for them to play in the game. And they're excellent role players, excellent content creators, and I admire them. By compensating them, I'm not taking away from other aspects of their life where they might be making money through other avenues. And at the end of the day, it's a form of respect, right?
Yeah.
I respect you and your time, and I will always pay an equal share. So if we want you to get paid more, well, shoot, we just got to bang the drum and get more patrons. That happens over time. I think we're consistent enough. And even if it all fell apart, I feel good about the work that we've done so far.
It's very cool. So if I want to watch Invisible Sun, tell me where I can see each of these, because you're on different channels. So tell me each of those channels, and do I have to watch all three or four? Or if I only have time to catch one channel and follow, you know, the story of these particular things, am I going to be totally lost, or is this something I need to watch all of?
The game advises you to not end on cliffhangers. They go, please never end a session on a cliffhanger. And the reason for that, a lot of people, especially in the streaming community, would be, but no, you want the audience to come back. Diddly-dee. And it's like, but this, it goes, no. Your players need the opportunity to have closure in the session.
Yes.
Get to the character summary. So I think the episodes are very similar to, say, chapters of a Three Musketeers novel, where it's like, this was published in the newspaper. Not everyone's always going to see every issue of the newspaper. So it's like,
yeah,
you get a self-contained story.
It's very nice. I do like that.
So you can see them every other Monday on Off the Table. That's where we have the Neon Life show. You can see them on WebDM on Wednesdays. That's Unearthly Twilights. And you can see them on Eric Vulgaris's Once Upon a Game channel, all of these on Twitch, on Saturdays. And our show times are 9 p.m. Eastern on Mondays, 8 p.m. Eastern on Wednesdays, and 4 p.m. Eastern on Saturdays. The Friday show, the time and start date are pending, but we can always append those later. And we are working on a massive YouTube playlist that will put the entire series chronologically, including some of the recorded side scenes. If someone does want to, you know, say they have a desk job, they just want to listen to some adventure, we'll probably do a playlist.
You want to binge it.
Yeah, if someone wants to binge watch. And my episodes are only 2 hours long, so that includes intros, outros, session recaps. So you could probably get through a story in like 90 minutes. And it would be self-contained. It's always helpful to know a little more. However, when I was a kid, I used to like to pick up books like comic strips and just open it up to the middle and start reading. Read all the way through, then come back and go to the beginning. Because a comic strip, you really learn how to tell a story in three panels most of the time. And that kind of three-panel structure is what I really strive for.
Very cool. All right, fill in the blank. This is our famous question, I guess. It's the question we always ask, at least.
It's the one question we always ask.
It's true. If you like blank, you'll like Invisible Sun, the project, not the game, or both.
If you like weird, you'll like Invisible Sun.
It's a good answer. All right. Thank you so much for coming and being on our show. If people want to join the Grant Ellis fan club, if they aren't already members, or talk to you about what brings them joy and despair, how can they do that?
They can find me on Twitter at WisePapaGrant, on Twitch, Grant R. Ellis, and on Patreon at Grant R. Ellis. Or if they're attending conventions, they can find me at PAX Unplugged. I'll be speaking on 4 different panels on a variety of topics, but if you see me at a convention, always come up and say hi, if you feel so inclined.
Yeah, I'm very excited to meet you at PAX Unplugged.
Likewise.
It's going to be fun. I'm going to prove, I've been talking to people, but I'm very excited to see that people have legs at PAX Unplugged.
And see, in mine, it's going to be like, wow, Grant has these little short tree trunk legs. I'm only 3'5".
Well, it was like, I was talking to somebody who met Eric Vulgaris for the first time. And
he's
like,
a giant.
He's very tall.
Eric is a giant.
Is he?
He's like an action figure. So Eric's like, he's tall and he's getting bigger and buffer. Like, he's a buff boy now every year. And then like, Grimjack, Greg, is also very tall.
Huh.
Tall yeah. Squall's big. He's tall. Tall Squall's in ridiculous shape. But like yeah. Dan Dillon's, the game designer, is literally Paul Bunyan. And James Hake's pretty close in height. And then I'm like, if you see any pictures of me with them, I'm like 2 head height shorter than everyone. And I'm like 5'9".
That's just side note jokes about seeing people's legs. Because we see people's faces and, like, mm-hmm. upper bodies torsos. a lot, but you don't often see legs. Do people have legs? Are they wearing pants when they stream? This is all important questions.
I sure
questions.
Hope so. I have a strict always pants policy.
Oh, that's
always
fair.
Pants.
Always pants.
Always pants. I never know when I'm going to stand up, and then the camera's going to be like, oh. They saw everything.
To be honest. Oh no, Twitch turns the surface. Shut down. All right.
I'm very glad you decided to talk to us about Invisible Sun today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really excited. I really want to play it with you because it sounds like 1000% my jam.
We should play sometime.
We should. Thank you to Grant for awakening our minds to the actuality, Jeff for being a compositional vislay, and you, the audience, for existing. We're really glad you're here.
It's true. If you want to tell us what you thought of this episode or suggest a creator to contact for future episodes, you can tweet us at TooManyRPGs, or you can contact Lauren at JL_NiceGirl.
Or Ethan at SuperRobotBear. If you like this episode, please leave us a review on your favorite podcatcher and recommend us to your friends. It really helps to spread the show to new people.
This has been one of many Too Many RPGs. Da-da-da. We already have outro music.
Okay. But I don't know. I always feel like we need a...
Well, there you go.